On To The Point, we try to make sense of the policy debates and the political sideshows on the campaign trail.
Neither party's agenda really aligns with who its coalition is today.
It was the dumbest speech I have ever seen in my life of covering politics.
When people walk into a voting booth, at the end of the day, they do say, I really should vote for someone smarter than me.
I'm Warren Altney. To The Point has you covered for the 2016 campaign. Find the To The Point podcast on KCRW's iTunes page.
Friends and fellow citizens, it was 41 years ago that I first spoke in this chamber. At that time, my father was rather surprised to see me make it to the governorship at such a young age. Now I'm kind of surprised that I'm still here, and three more years to go. That is, unless I take my surplus campaign funds and put a ballot initiative on the November ballot to allow fourth-term governors to seek a final fifth term.
California Governor Jerry Brown delivering his 13th State of the State speech a couple of hours ago. Since he came back to the governorship in the wake of the recession, he has been focused on fiscal discipline. And despite the state enjoying $6 billion in unanticipated revenue since just last summer, he is still singing that tune.
You're not going to hear me talk about new programs today. Rather, I'm going to focus on how we pay for the commitments we already have.
John Myers is Sacramento Bureau Chief for the LA Times. He's been covering the Capitol for a long time now, and he joins us. Hi, John.
Hello, Madeline.
So your colleague George Skelton, he of the LA Times, he tweeted that Brown's message was, quote, old-fashioned conservatism, save, pay down debt, no new toys, fix broken stuff, prepare for bad times, very un-Dem. Is that the read there in the Capitol?
Well, I mean, I would never quibble with my friend, our famed columnist. I mean, I think it is an interesting challenge that has played itself out now for several years of the governor's version of governing and those visions of his fellow Democrats in the legislature who tend to be more liberal than the governor. So, yes, this is a centrist left governor, if you want to try to find somewhere on the political spectrum to put him. And I think, Madeline, if you look at the speech, which was relatively short by political speeches, there was one line that I think sums up the whole thing, where the governor said the challenge is to solve today's problems without making those of tomorrow even worse. Mm. That has been pretty much Jerry Brown's calling card since he came back to Sacramento, to fix things but not spend too much money. And that is a real challenge in the push-pull world of politics.
Well, how big now is the Rainy Day Fund?
Well, the Rainy Day Fund has been growing. I mean, I think there are different ways to talk about what is a Rainy Day Fund in California, but certainly, and the voters strengthened the Rainy Day Fund in 2014 with Prop 2. The governor estimates that Rainy Day Fund will be upwards of about $8 billion in a couple of years if his plans move forward. But key to that is the governor trying to push about $2 billion more than the law even requires him to do, to push that money into the Rainy Day Fund soon. The bottom line is the governor really wants to take a lot of the unexpected tax revenues and sock them away into this fund more than the law requires him to do. And I think that's going to be a flashpoint with Democrats in the legislature who say, hey, maybe some of that additional money, we should look at some of the programs that were cut during the recession.
Yeah. So what are some of those programs that need more money?
Well, I think first and foremost, you're looking at social services programs is where the clash has been. You've got Democrats in the legislature, for example, believing that the governor has not done enough for welfare to work assistance, that the cash grants that families get who are trying to work and get themselves back on their own feet, that those cash grants haven't grown enough. You've heard a lot about child care slots and subsidized child care for the working poor. Again, places where Democrats think the governor hasn't done enough. Conversely, you've got Republicans who have argued that some of the governor's priorities, be they money for roads and bridge repair or be it money for health care coverage, should come out of this surplus cash and not additional tax revenues. And I think that is that place that the governor has positioned himself and continues to find himself in that push-pull of the politics of Sacramento.
Yeah. Okay, so you mentioned road repair. He did address that today. Let's take a listen.
Our overall state deferred maintenance is staggering. Estimated total, $77 billion. Most of that is in our roads, highways, and bridges. Here's our challenge. We have no choice but to maintain our transportation infrastructure. Yet doing so without an expanded and permanent revenue source is impossible. That means at some point, sooner rather than later, we have to bite the bullet and enact new fees and taxes for this purpose. Ideology and politics stand in the way, but one way or another, the roads must be fixed.
Okay, so are they going to bite the bullet and enact new fees or taxes?
The odds aren't great. The governor put a plan on the table last summer that still remains there about trying to address at least part of the unfunded needs in transportation around California. It centers on a brand new $65 a year fee on every vehicle, whether it's a gas guzzler or an electric car. That, of course, would require bipartisan votes in the legislature, and Republicans have not seemed to want to go along. I think most people up here, Madeline, believe that the odds are not great that that won't happen this year, because the other issue that the legislature is trying to deal with is extending a tax on health insurance companies that's about to expire that helps pay for Medi-Cal, the state's program for low-income families. And they think that that is a higher priority, extending that health care tax than the transportation money. The governor's going to try both, but this is an election year. People get awfully squirrely in politics about raising taxes or fees when voters are about to go to the polls.
Okay, let's talk about some of his other pet projects. Did he mention high-speed rail?
No. and not surprisingly in some ways, because it's become more and more unpopular. Polling shows that voters aren't so sure it's a great use of the money, and he's going to get more and more questions in the legislature, we expect, this year. So no mention of something that has not worked out the way he wants it to so far.
And those water tunnels? Any mention of those?
A very vague reference. The technical term for those tunnels around the Sacramento-San Joaquin Delta, Madeline, is conveyance. Hmm. And the governor used that one word, conveyance, that if you don't follow politics, you wouldn't have known is this controversial plan about water tunnels to bring water from the north to the south. Again, he's got a really tough road ahead of him trying to get that done. And he's going to keep trying, but he did not sell it expressly in the speech.
So what is his overall popularity, both in Sacramento and throughout the state? I mean, the state looks good financially. Does he get a lot of credit for that?
Yeah, I mean, I think if you look at the polls, the governor's job approval numbers are pretty good for as California governors go. They are somewhere in the low to mid-50s, depending on the poll, depending on the time, and that's pretty good. People seem to think he's doing a good job, but I do think a fascinating thing to watch this year is the fact that the recovery of California's economy has been very uneven. There are great pockets of success and great pockets of failure. And I think the governor is going to be asked more and more what to do to try to even that out some and to help those areas that have not recovered. And I think that is an ongoing challenge, because the governor seems to believe that there's only so much people in Sacramento can do, which sounds popular but is hard when people really want assistance in some of these programs. It's going to be interesting to watch.
Okay, and we will watch it. You will, up close. John Meyer, Sacramento Bureau Chief of the LA Times. Thanks, John.
You're welcome.
Well, one of Governor Brown's biggest accomplishments during his first term in office back in the 1970s was the creation of the California Coastal Commission. Its goal then was to preserve the state's coastline. But these days, the commission is more development friendly. And now members whom Brown appointed are trying to oust the executive director, who is not as development friendly. Former Commissioner Steve Blank is here now to tell us what's happening. Hi.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Great to have you. Well, let's start with what the commission actually does, why it was created, and what is its overall mission?
Well, what you mentioned was actually kind of an amazing experiment. 40 years ago, a very visionary Governor Brown saved the coast of California from what we call the tragedy of the commons, meaning we have a limited resource with lots of people wanting to use it and trying to figure out how to share it. And
mm-hmm.
We put some rules in place, some zoning rules that said, here's how we're going to share the coast for 40 million Californians now. And the data's in. After four decades, it's been an amazing success. You could drive from Santa Barbara to Santa Cruz and not seeing a single stoplight. It's the pride of California and the United States and maybe the world.
Well, how is it that the commission is so powerful to stop development on what is perhaps one of the world's most valuable pieces of real estate?
Well, you know, the Coastal Act basically had two goals. It said, number one, you wanted to maximize public access and public recreational opportunities on the coast while preserving the rights of private property owners, and two, to ensure priority for coastal development and coastal-related development over other development. That's a law. It's not like some staff's opinion. This is what Governor Brown signed 40 years ago. Incredibly visionary.
Okay, so what's happening now and with this fight over the executive director, Charles Lester?
So this has been a continual 40-year battle. If you think about it, property on the coast is, with these restrictions, think of zoning in your local community. You can't build a 40-story apartment building in a residential neighborhood, but you'd love to if you own that property. And in fact, if you could convince the local city council to allow you to build that 40-story apartment building, you're going to make a lot of money. So you'd hire a lot of lobbyists to change that law. We're seeing this played out almost yearly for the last 40 years, where developers try to essentially break the zoning of the coast by influencing commissioners through lobbyists. Hmm. And if they can't do that, then they're going to shoot the staff, because how it works is the staff, there's a permanent staff of 100-plus staffers with an executive director who make recommendations to the coastal commissioners. All 12 of them are political appointees. 8 of them serve for fixed terms, but 4 are at-will appointees of the governor, meaning he could replace them if he was unhappy with them in 30 seconds.
So why doesn't he do that? I mean, what does that say about his priorities and how they may have shifted over the decades?
Well, you know, I can't speak for the governor, and I think, as your previous guest said, the governor's accomplishments in these last two terms have been spectacular. I mean, he's gotten California on its feet, and the recovery is happening, and we have a large rainy day fund. But I kind of still like the first visionary governor rather than the accountant we have. And the question is, you know, people have been asking, what's the legacy of Jerry Brown? Is it going to be, are people going to ask that he sell out 40 million Californians for a few rich developers? And I don't think he's going to do that, but we're all kind of confused. To be honest, the Coastal Commission itself has been the one California agency that has not fallen victim to what's called regulatory capture. There's kind of a rough rule of thumb that says whatever regulatory body you set up to protect the people, within 7 years usually is captured by the very people you're trying to regulate. Hmm. Yet the Coastal Commission has remained independent for 40 years, protecting the rights of all Californians for coastal access. And yet we now have an assault by the developers' lobbyists who have convinced the governor's appointees to kind of change that game. And the amount of money that's at stake for developers, I would be doing that too. For example, there's proposals to build 1,400 houses in Southern California. If you just do the math, at $1 million a house nowadays, we're talking about $1.5 billion at play. Man, you could afford a lot of lobbyists to go do that. And those lobbyists and those developers make lots of campaign contributions to everybody. And so you could understand the amount of interest to change the zoning of your neighborhood. In this case, the neighborhood is the entire coast of California. And in this case, the people who should be interested and angry about this are all Californians, not just some political wonks following the Coastal Commission. This affects all of us, because all of a sudden, we might eventually look like the Jersey Shore. And I don't mean that to this New Jersey, but we've built something spectacular on the California coast by not building it.
Former California Coastal Commissioner Steve Blank, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
All right, we want to hear from you. Should there be a push for more development along the California shore, or should environmental concerns trump all? Give us a call at 1-844-PRESSPLAY. You can tweet us at KCRW PressPlay. Coming up, the comedy duo Frangela is here to talk about diversity and the Oscars and the call by Jada Pinkett Smith to boycott them. That's next on Press Play.
Make a donation of just a dollar a day, and you can join one of our exciting and exclusive Angel Clubs. Choose from music, books, DVDs, or cookbooks delivered right to your front door. Learn more and join now at kcrw.com/join.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. The Oscars So White controversy is still going strong. There have been reactions and reactions to the reactions. This week, actress Jada Pinkett Smith called for a boycott of the Oscar ceremony in a YouTube video she released on Martin Luther King Day.
I can't help but ask the question, is it time that people of color recognize how much power, influence that we have amassed? That we no longer need to ask to be invited anywhere.
Okay, joining me now to provide some perspective on this is Frances Collier and Angela V. Shelton, the comedy duo known as Frangela. Welcome, both of you.
Hello.
Welcome. Thank you for having us.
Nice to see you. It's been many years.
It has. It's been a minute.
And we're all so young.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And back then, maybe the Oscars weren't so white.
Yeah. No, actually, you know, well, man, they always have been.
Yeah.
So, tell us, what do you think of that Jada Pinkett Smith
You know, for me, thinking about civil rights, there's these moments in time that stand out. You know, the tragedy of four little girls being blown up at a church. You know, I Have a Dream, Rosa Parks, and now, of course, Will Smith not being nominated for an Oscar.
Right.
These things are all the same.
Yes, it's a travesty. No, seriously, what I think is, you know, it looks self-serving.
Looks?
I
believe
seems.
That this is the
That's
the
my opinion.
Because he wanted to get an Oscar nomination
exactly.
for Concussion.
And I'm not. And here's the thing. Hey. At the end of the day, he was promised an Oscar nomination.
We all actually, to be truthfully, we were surprised. Frances and I
were
surprised.
Shocked.
Because everything we had heard,
right.
about we haven't seen the movie yet. We're going to be honest on Front Street about that.
Uh-huh. Yes.
Now we probably aren't. But I'm just going
to
say.
I want to see it. I want to see
it. You'll see when it's on cable.
Yes, that's true.
But the point is that, like, I felt like he should have won an Oscar for Pursuit of Happiness. I think he's a wonderful actor. Mm-hmm. But trying to elevate, in the middle, we've talked about this a lot.
Yes.
In the middle of no indictments.
On
Sandra Bland or Tamir Rice,
right.
you know, Freddie Gray having a mistrial in the first cop trial, and getting no attention, you know, Black Lives Matters, and having a GOP ticket, which quite frankly is fascist in my opinion, and wholly racist, getting us on the Will Smith didn't get an Oscar nomination march.
I'm going to tell you something. It's, you picked the wrong moment.
Mm-mm.
And
uh-huh.
also, I don't see you out on the street.
You Hello,
like
preach.
Get behind
Thank you.
You. I need you to get behind these
Thank
issues.
Thank you, Frances.
Okay?
This is a couple that works hard to stay out of controversial issues.
Yes.
They are not, as far as I have ever known, been out here in the struggle. But now she going to equate his Oscar nomination. It is time for Black people.
Yes.
So had it been someone else, and in fact Spike Lee did
right,
yes, the same thing.
Right, yes.
He didn't call for a boycott necessarily. He just said he's sitting it out. But
that has been his voice and his perspective. I'm talking
for 20 years. For his, you know,
specifically this power couple, this Hollywood power couple.
Mm-hmm.
And here's the thing: they have a production company. They have power in Hollywood. And what do? They make scenes with their own kids.
They promote each other.
Yes.
Which I get. It's their family company. But the reality is, when I think about political activism in Hollywood, I think of people like Danny Glover.
Yes.
You know what I mean? Who are out there actually doing something?
Getting arrested.
You know, Martin Sheen.
Yes.
You know. But the idea that, first of all, this isn't the whitest Oscars ever. They've really always
been really white.
I think the atmosphere right now is so toxic, and race is, I think, in many ways, the number one wedge issue, if you will,
mm-hmm.
and that it gets a lot more attention, obviously. But we don't have Black people in Hollywood represented at any level or any minorities.
Yeah, I'm talking, I will take anybody with any
sound
kind of
engineer.
Melanin.
You know?
Some type of melanin. Asian, Native American,
Costume,
Latinos.
Wardrobe.
Yes.
So anything.
Here's the thing. When you talk about Oscars So White, we are not only talking about Black people.
No.
We're talking about people of color.
And women.
And let me tell you something. After the Sony fiasco, here's the thing. Everything in this industry this year is just being just lifted. The covers are being lifted up, you know?
But it's not
and
like,
we're seeing
yeah,
it.
It's not like there's ever been an Oscars where I was like, dang, there's so many Black people here.
Mm-hmm. Ooh, it's the blackest as far as the eye can see.
Did Soul Train switch places with the Oscars?
Whoa,
what happened?
Goodness, it's Black. blackity, black, black, black.
That has never happened. So that part, but I just thought it was beyond self-serving, and we love some Aunt Viv.
Yes, we did.
Okay, so this is the actress Janet Hubert. She played Aunt Viv on The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air. Those many years ago.
Yes.
And she produced this viral video. I think it's up to 2 million hits, where she really took on Jada Pinkett Smith and this very idea.
Yes.
Yes.
And so why do you think that has been so popular?
Oh,
girl, Madeline, because
it's juicy. It was so
it's
good,
juicy.
Madeline.
It hits the topic and it's juicy gossip.
Yes.
Because she was fired from the show?
No,
right?
I don't know about that.
There was another Aunt Viv.
There was another Aunt Viv.
Yeah.
But the issue that she actually brings out, which is wonderful, the most important thing she talks about is 26 years ago, the cast, when it was the number one show on the air, came to Will Smith and said, hey, can we get together like the white people did on Friends and come together in our contract negotiation and have a bigger situation of power to negotiate from?
Yeah.
And he said, no, your contract is your contract and my contract is my contract.
What?
But now you're going to ask today for black people to get behind you on your situation.
And you can tell, man, you've got to watch the video if you haven't watched it, because it got good to Aunt Viv. She leans back and she goes, karma, that's just karma. You know, she is so thrilled to finally be able to tell this story.
Yeah.
You know?
And has there been a reaction to that video?
Yes, Jada's now reacted to it,
gosh.
And Will, you know. And Jada's actually tried to back up off of it.
Yeah, she's like, oh, no, I didn't call for a boycott.
I wasn't calling for a boycott.
I'm
sorry, man. You just played the audio. Did that not sound like any minute and Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was going to fall out her mouth?
Yes.
any minute try to act like that wasn't what you were saying.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying? Have the courage of your convictions for at least 48 hours.
Yes.
So, you guys, you're not going to boycott watching the Oscars.
No.
Well, here's the thing. I'm watching for Chris Rock. I wouldn't call it a boycott.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Speaking of Chris Rock, how do you think he's going to handle this?
Well, he's
going to be fine.
Well, he is satirical.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. He's never backed down from these issues. And, you know, and he's...
The last time he hosted the Oscars, he brought it up.
Exactly.
You know, and it wasn't even front page to most people at that moment.
Right.
So, I don't think that he would come to it from a fearful place. But the reality is that boycott... What we're talking about is... We're not represented. So is it really actually smart to not go and be represented?
I feel like we should do any black actors or people who can get into the Oscars, because we, you may not notice, we don't have invitations.
No.
But if
you
have
one. But I'm going to stand by the door in case, you know, they need a seat filled or something.
Thank you. I think they should do what the Muslim American woman did at the Trump rally, and I can't remember her name. I feel bad for that. But stand up and be quiet.
Yeah.
You want to protest? Protest.
Yes.
You know, like, but do it
in the room.
And do something that matters with that. Or when you have the opportunity, and like, because this is so often true, even if we are talent on something, I look around that room and everybody working it is not, they're all white, you know? Get some black PAs, get some black sound people, get some black or minorities of any sort.
Yes.
I'm saying black people because we talk about blackness.
Right.
But I mean everybody, you know? There's so few women directors, almost no women showrunners, you know? So we don't get to hear those stories. I don't get to write Bridesmaids.
Yeah.
You know, I can only write for black women than Hollywood. That's what we get told on a daily basis.
Really?
Yeah.
I mean, literally told.
People actually say that.
Oh, yes.
Oh, yes.
The white men who are writing the show for black women who are hiring us tell us that.
Yes.
So they bring you in to add some reality?
Well,
yes.
As consultants.
As consultants.
I see.
Yeah. So, I mean, we could go on and on about the issue of, and people are, and I'm glad it's getting addressed, but I think what Jada Pinkett Smith did was hysterical, ridiculous, laughable. And I'm going to enjoy making fun of her for it for a very long time.
Yeah, you know, she was in that situation where, you know, when you're mad and somebody tells you to write that letter, you're going to write that letter to that person because
you're
mad.
Well, you can tell it was kind of late at night. I think people were asleep and she was kind of whispering.
Yeah, so she was in her feelings. She was hot and
she
tight.
She was in her feelings. She needed a journal for a minute.
Exactly.
Or
but
call
you know how
somebody.
You're not supposed to mail that letter? You're not supposed to hit send on the
email? Your girlfriend's supposed
to go,
look, wait, girl, wait. Let's wait till tomorrow.
Yes.
But I think that she's pretty surprised, probably.
Oh, yes.
By the reaction.
Yes.
I think that's what happens when you live in a bubble of your own fame and wealth, that you start to think that you actually have an issue here.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like Gwyneth Paltrow thinking she's every woman. I feel like people start to think that they actually have, and then she's going, I think she thought up there, sitting in that living room, she's like, you know what? People are going to get behind us on
this.
Yes.
I have a message.
We don't have to wait to be invited.
Mm-mm.
We don't.
So... Are they going to show up or not, do you think?
They're not going to show up.
I wouldn't if I was them. Because
really
Chris
wouldn't.
Rock, I would mock them throughout the entire show.
And you know what? And here's the thing. They can still, use that time that he would be using to campaign for his Oscar, use it on the issues that are out there affecting people of color right now.
Yeah.
I would love, that's my invitation to you,
yeah.
Mr. and Mrs. Smith.
Join us in our boycotts.
Yes.
How about that?
And then I can get behind you. And if you do that, if they do that mm-hmm. right now, today,
preach.
I will, I will be out there every day in front of they, in mm-hmm. front of somebody's office being like, give Will Smith an Oscar.
We got to see the movie first. We do have to, because it might be bad.
I don't care.
It might be bad. We should actually see it.
I want to thank you both for coming in.
Thank you.
All right. That's Frangela. They are a comedy duo, Frances Collier and Angela V. Shelton. Yo. Okay, your turn. What do you think about protesting the Oscars via boycott? Is it worthy? Is it worthless? Do you agree with Frangela? Do you not? Share your thoughts by leaving a voicemail at 1-844-PRESS-PLAY, or you can leave a comment on our Facebook page, KCRW Press Play. Coming up on the program, surveillance and dissent. How the web is being used to monitor political protests.
Why should they be watching these groups so closely? Why should they be trying to disrupt this stuff? When you start asking those questions, it's very disturbing.
A new TV series explores the line between privacy, security, and freedom of expression. That story after a news update with Eric Roy.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Ashley Yates is a young Black Lives Matter activist. She's also known as Brown Blaze. That's her Twitter handle. And she has nearly 30,000 followers, so a pretty wide audience. Still, she was surprised when she traveled from her home in Missouri to New York City for a protest, and some police officers there in New York recognized her as Brown Blaze. Yates took it as proof that the police had been tracking her on social media. She and other Black Lives Matter activists say they've been subjected to extensive online monitoring. Their stories and others about surveillance in the digital age are part of a new series called Truth and Power. It debuts on the Pivot Network Friday. Brian Knappenberger is the executive producer of Truth and Power, and he's in the studio now. Welcome.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
Well, let's start with that first episode, mm-hmm. the Black Lives Matter episode. And you talk about the origin of the hashtag.
Yeah.
Black Lives Matter. And that's interesting. I didn't know it started right here in California with a few women.
That's right. Yeah, it started basically after the Trayvon Martin verdict came in with George Zimmerman. And a group of women, mostly almost exclusive women at the beginning, took that hashtag and sort of started talking about it, started a discussion that really became a nationwide discussion about race and police brutality.
And it became a social movement.
A huge, huge social movement. I mean, I think one of the biggest, if not the biggest, social movement of the 21st century so far.
And so with social movements comes law enforcement surveillance?
Yeah. So in our telling of that story, we look at how they use those kind of digital tools in order to organize and to create this movement. But we also look at the way that law enforcement has pushed back on them and used both track their social media use and also use digital tools in order to surveil them and do other things.
Well, you interview one police officer who says, look, we're just using things that are in the public domain. We're just using Facebook, Twitter, to look at these activists. So what's wrong with that?
Exactly. So his point is that this is a police officer in Oakland. And he says, yeah, we use social media and we monitor these groups using publicly available information. And that there isn't anything wrong with that. He says they are part of the public. Police are part of the public. And that's fine. And I think that that's true and that's to be expected. But it's not just that. You know, the police are using all sorts of other surveillance tools now to disrupt protest groups. And some of them are a lot more invasive and a lot more questionable legally.
And what are some examples?
Well, I think we explore a couple of these in the series. One example, actually we dedicate a whole episode to this, is the Stingray. So a Stingray is a kind of cell phone simulator, a cell phone site simulator that basically tricks your phone into thinking that it's connecting to a friendly cell phone tower when it's not. It's actually connecting to this Stingray, and then that information, call information, or all potentially other information that's on your phone, which is pretty much everything about our lives now, can then be intercepted by a third party. So law enforcement does this. You're not just targeting one individual when you're surveilling somebody. You're targeting everybody within that cell phone range.
And this all came to light in the case of a guy named Daniel Rigmaiden. Mm-hmm. Tell us about him. He is quite a character.
Yeah. So I believe this is our third episode. We dedicate actually completely to the story of Daniel Rigmaiden. Daniel Rigmaiden is the first guy to get the government to say the word Stingray, to reveal this. Lots of people suspected that this kind of cell phone site simulator technology was being used. He, through sheer force of will and tenacity, representing himself while he was in jail, forced the government to reveal that they were using this device and brought up some really strong constitutional kind of questions about its legality.
He was in jail for tax fraud.
He was in jail, yeah. I think he was in jail for tax fraud. And when he was arrested, he told me in an interview, he knew immediately they had tracked it to this air card that he'd used, this card that he had put into his laptop that was using the cell phone site. He didn't know how they tracked that air card, but he was so careful and so knowledgeable about how these things worked that he knew it was something to do with that. So he dedicated his time, once he had a lot of time in prison. First of all, he represented himself. And so he went through. He had to learn a lot about just the law when it comes to these things. But then he also had to learn about the technology involved, and he was the one that figured this out.
So was he basically arguing that, okay, maybe I did this, you caught me, but this is an illegal search and seizure, and so this should be tossed? Was that his argument?
That's exactly the argument, yeah.
And he lost, obviously, because he went to jail?
He went to jail, and then he argued this case, and he actually lost, but I think he was so tenacious about it that they just kind of were sick of dealing with him at some point. And so they let him go at some point with time served, which is surprising to a lot of people. There was a big effort to keep the technology itself secret.
Okay. So you also have another episode where you talk about malware. Mm-hmm. First of all, define malware. What is that?
Malware, a lot of people think about malware as when you click on an email of some sort and something downloads to your computer that then does something to your computer that you didn't authorize, right? And malware can do all sorts of things. It can record your keystrokes. It can turn off and on your camera, the microphone on your computer. It can send files from your computer.
All without you knowing.
Yeah, it can place files on your computer. That's malware. The episode that we explored was pretty interesting. We started this looking into this story when we learned that 100 people throughout the world were arrested after using a specific kind of malware called Black Shades. And these were mostly kids, and they were doing some awful things with it. They were famously Miss Teen USA. Her computer was infected with malware, and pictures were taken of her and all of that. So this is what started that. That investigation. And these kids were buying this malware for around 30 or 40 euros. That was about the price where you could buy this stuff and then you could employ it. But what was amazing is that once we started looking into that, we realized that actually there are a lot of companies around the world that sell something very, very similar to governments around the world to spy on their own citizens. And of course, they charge a lot more than 40 euro, uh-huh. You know, sometimes, you know, $1 million and stuff a pop. But they're selling very similar tools to governments, some pretty awful governments around the world that were then using them to spy on dissidents and journalists and activists. We tracked down some activists in Morocco that were targeted with specific software, this specific malware. And so we follow their stories, this sort of trail of where this malware came from. We tracked it back to this company, Italian company called The Hacking Team. And one of the most remarkable parts of this story is that in the middle of us investigating the hacking team, that company was itself hacked. And we actually got an interview with someone from the hacking team who said that they were very careful about the governments that they sell this stuff to, that they vet those governments very closely. And after that interview, we were able to then look at this big dump of their own internal company emails and look at a lot of their sort of sales receipts and all of that. So this kind of remarkable thing happens in the middle of us investigating. There's a hack of the hacking team.
And so does it turn out that they are indeed selling their software to really bad governments?
Yes.
Is there any instance you think where these tools are actually put to good use, where governments or private individuals might need to have these tools?
I mean, I've been a part of the anti-surveillance debate for quite a long time, even before the kind of remarkable revelations of Edward Snowden. And I think during that whole time, I've never heard people that say that there shouldn't ever be surveillance or there shouldn't be a time in which this is important. Most of the complaints, the real complaints, are the kind of mass dragnet, suspicionless surveillance of citizens.
But in a world where you have San Bernardino and ISIS recruiting online, mm-hmm. I mean, you can see why law enforcement would want to have these tools.
You can see why they would want to have them, but there are restrictions and checks on power.
But what is your opinion when it comes to protesters who may engage in civil disobedience or disruptive activity, may try to, let's say, shut down a freeway and perhaps put, you know, lives in danger, at least inconvenience a lot of people? Mm-hmm. Do you think surveillance is ever warranted in that case in terms of monitoring these groups and what they're doing?
I think the surveillance is out of control in those cases. I mean, it's, again, not that there is never a reason for that. Certainly some people do bad things. But civil disobedience, technically, is breaking the law, breaking a law that you believe is unjust. Mm-hmm. And so I think that in that case, people understand that they're breaking the law. And you get arrested and maybe spend a night in jail, maybe it's a misdemeanor, but you kind of understand that you're engaged in this activity for a reason.
Yeah, and it's easier to handle, I guess, if you're a protester and you know exactly, you can see the police officer there watching you, but yeah. If you don't know who's watching you, when and where, I suppose there would be a certain amount of uneasiness associated with that. What has been the reaction on the part of the protesters to this news that they are being surveilled?
Well, I think to some degree, you know, we live in an environment where people understand that what they see, what they post online is viewable. But when it comes to these kind of more invasive things, you know, we have a long history of this. The FBI has a history of trying to break up civil rights movements. You know, it's a pretty—
The COINTELPRO program.
With the COINTELPRO mm-hmm. program, yeah. And so when you start to get into that territory, you're getting into something that's very, very disturbing and that's very, very against the basic notion that we have that it's okay to stand up, that it's, that participating actively in society is a good thing. So why should they be watching these groups so closely? Why should they be trying to disrupt this stuff? I think it's when you start asking those questions, it's very disturbing.
Yeah. Well, given the fact that you just told me you've been working in this field for quite some time, pre-Edward Snowden, do you think you're being tracked and monitored?
I don't know. I mean, the biggest concern that I have always had in looking at stories of people is that in my communications with them are secure and that I'm not putting anybody, by trying to figure out the story, I'm not putting someone in danger.
So do you use encryption when you...
Yeah.
On everything?
No, I don't. I mean, I think you have to look at what you call the threat model. Who might be listening to you and when and for what purpose? So those kinds of communications with sources or people that are necessarily in vulnerable positions, that is the highest level of protection that I ever engage in.
Well, thanks so much for coming in.
Of course. Thank you very much.
Brian Knappenberger is the executive producer of the TV series Truth and Power. It debuts on the Pivot Network on Friday. Warren Olney is here now to tell us what's happening at 1 o'clock. Hello.
Well, I'm going to go back to 1971 when Richard Nixon first declared war on cancer. 600,000 people still get cancer, of course, and many of them die of it today. So we're going to talk about Joe Biden and the moonshot against cancer. He's not promising a cure. Nobody would want to do that now, and that would create false expectations. But he is talking about trying to speed up the extraordinary research that has been done in cancer, or against cancer, I should say. But it's not an easy thing because researchers are so divided. There's what he refers to as cancer politics.
Well,
involved.
Plus cancer is such an umbrella term for so many different kinds of
cancer. There are hundreds of different kinds of cancer, and every individual is different, as we are all different from one another because of our genetics.
Right.
So everybody has it in a different way. We have we're going to hear a very interesting story about two women who have exactly the same kind of cancer but who get treated for it in utterly different ways, one in New York, one in Nebraska. And what that says about the way research is done, how little collaboration there is, and how that's one of the things that the vice president's really interested in, is trying to get everybody together rather than all working at cross purposes. But, of course, when companies, particularly drug companies, have big money involved in doing the research, they don't want to collaborate or cooperate, I should
right.
say.
And maybe they want to look into one particular form of cancer and not another particular form of cancer.
There's no coordination. There's no.
Will there be any government seed money for this research?
Big money, yeah, $2 billion already.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So the president putting his money where his mouth was at the State of the Union.
Yeah.
All right. We're in only at 1 o'clock. To the point. Thank you.
Okay.
And coming up on this program, we'll continue our talk about the dark web and surveillance. Shani Jardin is here for our weekly web roundup. That's next on Press Play.
Browse the KCRW store and shop for vacations, wine classes, frequent flyer miles, dinners, and merchandise. Shop to support KCRW only at kcrw.com/store.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Before the break, we talked about a TV show that looks at how surveillance may be going too far in the digital age. Well, another documentary TV series is taking a look at people who use the internet to do things they probably don't want anyone to see. We're going to talk about that and other news of the web and technology with Shani Jardin. Hi.
Hi. It's me.
It is you. In the flesh. Not as, on the internet.
As the memes say, it me.
Why use verbs? All right. So tonight, Showtime will premiere part one of its 8-part documentary. It's called Dark Net. And it's kind of a misleading title because it's not really about the dark web, but about the more sinister effects of technology on people.
This is the most fulfilling and satisfying relationship that I've had. Miss Christie can see what I'm doing, whether I like it or not.
Are you wearing your cage today?
I tried to call her. She wouldn't answer her phone.
I had been taken in by a cult.
People kill because of social media.
All right. Sounds tantalizing.
So basically, this is like Boing Boing circa 2003 onward. We've been blogging about creepy, sexual, fringe lifestyle, I believe in aliens, and they're talking to me through my dental implants. This is the world that we live in. I'm skeptical, but also kind of stoked about the fact that this is a TV show now.
Right. But aren't they trying to answer a bigger question? And that question being, is technology actually changing us and changing us in irrevocable ways?
So my two-part answer is, yeah, and duh.
That was supposed to be a deep question, Shani.
Of course it's changing us. Look, everything that we do now, from waking up in the morning to cooking our breakfast to working and communicating and understanding what's going on in the world around us, all of this happens with technology's involvement. You know, Kevin Kelly, one of the founding editors of Wired magazine, once said that if any technology is, say, 52% good and the remainder is bad or indifferent, then over time, that goodness kind of accrues. There's a Japanese word for it, kaizen, that refers to this idea of incremental change, incremental improvement. And I like to think about that with technology. So if technology has the potential for good, and we as a society push for that, then I think the outcomes are good.
So it seems this series, by the very title, Darknet, is saying the opposite.
Well, I think it's fun to explore the dystopian possibilities, the worst case scenarios. It makes for wonderful sort of a horror, surreal experience. It's why we love cyberpunk novelist like William Gibson or Bruce Sterling or our own
Blade Runner and that kind of thing.
And our own Cory Doctorow at Boing Boing. So this is fun material to explore, but just don't take it too seriously. There's still a little bit of science fiction in all of this.
All right. Speaking of Nielsen, the ratings people, they are saying they want to expand their use of social media to give information to television companies, producers, what have you, as to what people are saying about their programs. Now, they do this already, but now they want to tap into private conversations.
Well, if there's a possibility for Facebook to respect our privacy even less, I'm sure that that will happen in this situation. But basically, the media research firm has been under pressure for a long time to kind of get with the times. People aren't watching television on television sets as much as they used to. It's dare I say it, a dying medium. Mm. And the internet is really emerging in the forefront. Social media is really emerging in the forefront. Some people were saying this is why Al Jazeera America died, because they didn't take that digital strategy seriously enough. So Nielsen is under pressure. They have been very eagerly striking deals with the likes of Twitter. They have a social content rating system that began with Twitter data. And I think they're, look, at Boing Boing, we get like 5 to 1, the ratio of referral traffic from Facebook compared to Twitter. Facebook is 5 times of a bigger referral for us. So I know that all of the companies involved in television production and distribution would really like to have their hands on some of that.
This info.
Some of that usage info.
But do you
info.
Find that kind of scary for the people who use it, that somebody's listening in on our conversations, or just who cares, don't post about your favorite TV show if you don't want people to know?
I think participating in Facebook in any way requires a concession of some rights around privacy. This is a private platform that serves to generate profit for shareholders. Mm. I mean, that really is what it is. Yeah. This is not the free and open web. So you don't have much of a privacy expectation on Facebook. Get used to it.
Okay. How blunt. Speaking of, Google is now closing in on being the world's most valuable company. That title belongs to Apple at $540 billion.
Million.
Google is just a mere $50 billion away from capturing that title. Just a mere $50 billion.
Excuse me, Madeline. Actually, they prefer to be called Alphabet now. They're like the artist formerly known as Prince that's now again known as Prince.
Okay, the parent company of Google.
Yes.
Okay. But for you and me and everyone
it's
else,
Google.
It's back to Google. Okay. So Google is, you know, what do you think about that? I mean, this is a company that doesn't make anything.
Yep. So last I checked, Apple has a $542.5 billion market cap. So that's a $47 billion lead over Google, Alphabet, whatever we're going to agree to call it. And basically, there is some speculation. There's like a little betting pool on whether there's a possibility that Alphabet, Google, could surge forward. I think that's only going to happen if Apple announces a lower than expected earnings and Alphabet really hits it out of the park. And both of these calls, the earnings reports are set for, let's see, January 26th for Apple, and Alphabet is February 1st.
Uh-huh. But what does that tell you in terms of, I don't know, just in terms of what makes money these days? And this is, again, information that they are making money off, our information, right?
It's interesting because I think it really speaks to the fact that very large companies who aspire to have the kind of domination that Apple and Google each do, let's get real about it, they can't just be in the hardware business. They can't just be in the operating system business. They can't just be in the app business. They can't just be in the entertainment business or ad business. They have to throw a lot of spaghetti against the wall. And, Apple began making computers. And now we know Apple as a provider of entertainment. They have tried to launch a news publication service, essentially. They have retail, they have hardware, they're doing all sorts of things, and all of that generates sweet, delicious, precious data. And Google is doing the same.
Yeah.
So in the end, I think we're moving toward a future, which may be happy or dystopian, I don't know yet, in which intelligence about what information people want to access, when and how and why and how much they're willing to pay for that, that really is going to be the backbone of our commerce in the future.
The near future.
Well, like maybe
like
now.
Like the now future.
We battle in the future for us is the now. That's how advanced we are here at KCRW.
My mind is blown. All right. Shani Jordan, co-editor of BoingBoing.net. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madeline.
Julie Myers is here now to give us the listener breakdown.
I like when they play the music extended cut at the beginning because I can get really into my dance party that I have every day.
Of your theme,
Julie's theme. Yeah, Julie's theme. I wish it was actually called that. So we talked earlier in the show about the Coastal Commission, the California Coastal Commission, the fact that there's upheaval within the ranks. They might be losing their executive director and an ouster. Rob called in. He's worried about a plan to develop some pristine land in Orange County. He says that there are 1,400 homes proposed to be built on the coast.
And actually, that's on Banning Ranch, beautiful coastal bluffs overlooking the ocean. And that's an exact instance of why we need the Coastal Act and why we need executive directors like Charles Lesser, who forcefully spoke out in favor of preserving those coastal bluffs for future generations of Californians.
So he was talking in favor of the environmentalist current leader of the Coastal Commission. Developers, if you want to call in, there's room for you always. 844 press play. We also talked about Oscars So White today.
We did.
And
we had
boy,
a very raucous discussion.
I think raucous is a very good word for it, and needed would be another word for it. So we had another caller who wanted to weigh in on this story. His name is Grant, and here's what he's going to do about the Oscars.
Now, what I'm going to do is I want to boycott the Oscars for being racist, so I'm not going to watch them on TV. But I do really want to see Chris Rock and hear everything he has to say. So I'm just going to watch the Oscars on YouTube a couple days later so I can see it, but so that I don't give it any higher ratings from my viewership.
In other words, he's not giving that sweet, sweet, delicious data that Shani Jordan was
just talking about. Real time.
But it sounds like a good plan. I mean, if you want to know.
I mean, frankly, that's what people do anyway for a lot of these shows.
I'm just going to watch the link roundup the next day of all the highlights of it, because boy, is there downtime in those. Besides Oscars So White, I mean, for me, it's kind of Oscars So Boring. Like, I'm sorry, but
that's been a longstanding complaint. And you just sort of sit through it because, what, there's a drinking game associated with it? Or
well,
you
I do like
the
Oscars. I was just going to say that. You know, Madeline and I totally, the day after awards shows, we don't look at who won. We look at the Oscars fashion.
We have our own.
And skip past all the tuxes because they're always boring. We have a really good debate going on Facebook as well. About Oscars So White. So if our listeners want to join in, go to actually the main KCRW page and find the picture is straight out of Compton. So if you want to join in the debate, that's where it's happening.
Okay, excellent. And you can also check out our Facebook page, KCRW Press Play, and Twitter at KCRW Press Play. Julie Myers, thank you very much.
You are so welcome.
He looked fabulous, by the way. Nice outfit. All right, Warren Olney is up next to the point at 1 o'clock, so keep it right here on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll be at Sundance for the next week, so you will have Barbara Bogave in tomorrow, Steve Chiotakis next week, but I'll be with you. I will. See you later.